Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this now, our third pre-Pesach webcast being held in the world headquarters of the Orthodox Union in Lower Manhattan, New York City. We are in the presence of Moreno Harav HaGaon Rabbi Yisrael HaLevi Belsky, Rosh Yeshiva of Torah Vadas, an OU senior posek, and Moreno Harav HaGaon Rabbi Herschel Shechter, Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, as well as OU senior posek. Together with us, as always, is also Rabbi Eli Gerstein, who is the recorder of the OU Psak and special rabbinic coordinator to disseminate the Piskei Halacha of the Orthodox Union Poskim. Some of you may have already heard his most recently posted kosher tidbit on the Inyonim of Kitniyos, and also the explanation of the OU's new a symbol of OU kosher lePesach for Ochlei Kitniyos. If you haven't as yet heard that tidbit, please do. It's very, very well said, articulate, and to the point. And with us as well, as always, is Rav Elio Farrell, my dear chaver and colleague who assists us in all the OU kosher educational programs, as well as the person who posts those very, very articulate and sometimes funny but to the point blurbs on the OU kosher tidbits, of which we now have over 150 posted. The pre-Pesach webcast today will focus on inyonim of Bedikas Chometz, Mechiras Chometz, Chometz after Pesach, as well as Inyone HaSeder and the Haggadah, Inyonim that we have not focused on in the past webcasts that we have presented to you. We have received numerous shilas, as well as shilas from Chaverim and Eretz Yisrael. And talking about Eretz Yisrael, I hope that my grandchildren, Yonatan and Nachum in Modi'in, are listening in to the Divrei Torah of the Rabbonim HaGaonim. And perhaps before Pesach, Yonatan and Nachum, I'm going to ask you to repeat some of the wonderful Divrei Torah that you've heard here today. We'll begin with some questions for Rav Shechter relating to Bedikas Chometz. Rav Shechter, if one is going away for Pesach, but there will be guests that are only sleeping in the house, what needs to be kept in mind regarding eliminating Chometz and Bedikas Chometz? Am I allowed to go into my house on Pesach if my plans change?
The Gemara says that if a person is leaving his home within 30 days before Pesach, even if he does not plan to come back for Pesach, he still has to do Bedikas Chometz. There are different opinions whether a bracha is recited. Some Shulchan Aruch, the accepted opinion, is that a bracha is not recited whenever the Bedikah is done before Leil Yudalid. Or if it's a year that Pesach falls out on Shabbos, if the Bedikah is done before Leil Yud Gimel. So even if you're leaving your home, if a person leaves his home before 30 days, he's only obligated to be Bedik Chometz if he plans to come back in the middle of Pesach. Whenever a person leaves his home, usually within 30 days before Pesach, he's obligated to be Bedik Chometz, even if he's not going to have someone else around the house. Now, we have all kinds of chumras that people observe. People put shmatas on their faucets, and people put the lining in the refrigerator, all kinds of things. If the person doesn't plan to be at home, and the guests who are going to be there are just going to be sleeping, they're not going to be eating this, he doesn't have to put shmatas on his faucets, whatever other chumras he has. He's permitted to come to his home in the middle of Pesach, but if his practice is that he puts shmatas on the faucet, then if he changes his mind to stay in his home on Pesach, he should start putting the shmatas on, and so on.
Must each member of the family of Shechter recite the Bitul Chometz, or is it sufficient for the head of the household to make the Bitul Chometz, to declare the Chometz null and void in front of everyone?
I don't think it's like Kiddush and Havdalah, that if one person says Kiddush, everybody's Yotzei. Whoever owns the Chometz and stands to violate Bayurat by Motzei has to recite the Bitul. So sometimes the children have their own spending money, or the wife has a right to spend her own money, and she buys her own chametz that she keeps in her own pocketbook. And if she was by the chametz and she didn't find it, then more correct is that the wife and the children should say their own bitul chametz on whatever chametz may possibly belong to them.
And finally, if a piece of chametz is very difficult to reach, need there be heroic efforts made to remove it?
I don't think so. It's too difficult. You just rely on the bitul chametz. Gemara discusses that, but I think the assumption is halacha l'maaseh that you just you rely on the bitul chametz, not mechuyev to go crazy.
Ravelsky, in order to have a valid mechira, is it necessary to have a change of ownership that is also valid according to common law, or is it enough to have a transfer that is valid lehalacha?
It definitely should be something that's valid according to the law of the land, because it's between a Jew and a non-Jew. It perhaps it's possible for two Jews to arrange a mechir between each other in a manner that's you know, that the country, the land, is not makbid on, but it should be legal according to the halacha, even though it's not kafi into the chukei medina, but definitely not between a Jew and a non-Jew. And especially, this is very important, especially if the non-Jew has no intention to honor the mechira, if he feels that it's just some religious recitation and it has no validity at all, then it's worthless. It definitely has to be done in a way which is consistent with the law.
If one sells his chametz to a goy, as per the common custom, and one finds some chametz on Pesach, what should one do? How can you destroy it if it belongs to the goy? I've heard, the questioner asks, that some include in the shtar a specific provision that if a Jew finds chametz, he has permission to dispose of it. Should this be included in the shtar lechatchila?
Let's examine what we mean by finding chametz on Pesach. If a storekeeper sells his chametz, then he knows where the chametz is and he finds it all. It's hidden behind a sheet or a closet or whatever it is, but he has huge amounts of chametz which he sold, and there's no one who has a minig not to sell chametz from the store that he owns, because there's no other way of conducting the business without having chametz. Perhaps he would want to be machmer and remove it to a different premises, but he'll definitely be forced to sell it to a goy. And he knows where the chametz is. There's no discovery, and of course he's not going to burn it. The entire mechir is made for that purpose, so that it should continue to exist throughout Pesach. When a homeowner sells chametz, he should sell a certain specific amount of chametz, which he feels he just can't get rid of. Perhaps the schnapps, the whiskey, or medicines, or perfumes, or certain things which he feels he just has to keep over Pesach. And that's why he sells it and still leaves it in the home. But it's been customary in recent years, and quite recently, to extend the shtar, perhaps the last 150 years or so, to extend the shtar mechira to include all little bits and crumbs of chametz and pieces that may be found anywhere in the house. In other words, to actually use the mechira's chametz not as a way of holding on to the inventory in the store, or in a hotel, or pieces in the private home that have to be kept for one reason or the other, but just sort of as an additional way of being mekayim tashbisu, getting rid of the chometz, in addition to vedika and bittel. So we'll do it through mechira, because people are so nervous and fearful of finding chometz that they say they're going to sell any chometz that's found. If there's a crumb, if there's a piece of cake, if there's a hamantash found anywhere in the house, it should also be sold. Chometz hanidbak bekelim, chometz hanivla bekelim, some people sell. And once you do that, you do get into trouble, because you find a piece of chometz somewhere in the house, and the gluske yofe, and you don't want to hold on to that. You want to get rid of it. Although there's no reason for getting rid of it. You should just take it and cover it. It's chometz that belongs to a goy. Make a mechitz of ten tvachim, or put it on cholomoid, it's in that mukzit, put it away. That's really what one should do. Now, people are nervous at both ends. After they make the bedik and the bittel, they still want to sell chametz that they weren't successful in finding and that they may have not been mechaven to be mevatel, and they want to get rid of that through mechira. And if they find it, they somehow are nervous about finding it. Maybe the mechira wasn't mikavon and they want to burn it. There's really no etzet to get around every form of nervousness that there is. They want to put in a stipulation into the mechira and say that if they should discover a piece of chometz, then retroactively it shouldn't be sold. I mean, then you don't accomplish anything with that additional mechira.
So talking about the nervousness, Ravelsky, one asked, should one be concerned about removing tiny crumbs that may be chometz, that may be found in furniture, between the cracks, chadome?
For the purpose of Tashbisu, the crumbs don't mean anything. Pirudin lo chashiva, the Gemara says. But we're worried about people who sit on the couch and take a piece of food and they'll touch the crumb on the couch or in the fold of the couch with that piece of food that they have in their hands, the Pesach food, and then they'll eat that crumb along with their food. And perhaps consider it a tarovus, and it will last the whole thing with a mashu on Pesach. Of course, the minig is to try to get rid of crumbs. Ramos says that the person should carry a feather duster along with him when he's being boided chometz to get rid of crumbs. It's not necessary for tashbisu, but we try to get rid of the crumbs. But every chumrah has to have a limitation. Person can't go around nervously and just keep, attacking the impasti crumb that's hidden away. We spoke before about a piece of chometz that's difficult to get. If you have a chometz in a boyer or a chometz bishmeikoyer, there's a limit to the effort that a person has to do to get rid of chometz. But I think that anything that's included in the cleaning. The person cleans very well before Bedikas Chometz, so they go over with vacuum cleaners and dusters and everything until those little crumbs aren't there. Bedikas Chometz is not meant for the crumbs. It's to be gotten rid of for a totally different reason, so it shouldn't touch the food that you eat on Pesach. But again, every additional chumrah is a chumrah da'asidli de'kula, because when a person is so nervous about b'dikas chometz, so he'll sell the house and go away to a hotel and not enjoy Pesach.
So if I sell the house before the time of the b'dika, do I need to do a b'dika?
No, if a person really sold his house before the time of the b'dika, so he doesn't need to make a b'dika at all. Of course, he could be like a Yoytze B'Shayori. He has to go to a new place where he could be by the Chometz and be in a Leil Yudalit, the night of the Deacon. But selling a house is a very complicated thing. We spoke before about having a legal sale. To go and make a legal sale of a house is something that most people are not really equipped to do at all. And especially a sale between a Jew and a non-Jew, is to go down to the city offices and have it registered, make a title search. I don't know what's involved in selling a house.
So in other words, the people who say that I'm selling my house, it's a stam geret.
Well, let me tell you, this is why I advise people: if someone's old and decrepit and sick, and he can't make a bedika, and there are many such people. So then they could sell the house, l'chol hapachas, rent it out to a goy. and go make bedikah in a small room, leave one room in the house. It has to be a room which is a makom shemachnisim by chametz, otherwise it's valueless. Because if he'll leave a room in the house which is not mechuyev in bedikah, then he wasn't yotze with his mitzvah bedikah. And perhaps be by the chametz in the new place, in the hotel, in the family home where he'll go to. So those are good things for people who are unable to make a bedikah. But for people who are able to make, they're healthy and they're young enough to be able to go around the house for a sufficient time to make a bedikah, they should make a bedikah chametz.
So, Baruch Hashem, today we have people that have more than one residence. Let's say a residence in New York and another one in Florida, or better yet, one in New York and one in Yerushalayim. So, someone asked, we have two residences and we're leaving our principal residence, say in New York, on March 16th, not returning until after Pesach. We're moving into our second residence at that time, where we intend to stay all of Pesach.
Yeah. So,
what do we do for cleaning and bedikah the principal residence?
Clean it and make bedikah. If one believes within 30 days of Yontif, Shechter mentioned before, so then you have to make bedikah. If one leaves probably for a Pesach vacation in the other residence, so they surely stay within the 30 days. They don't leave 30 days before. So they should make two bedikas. Hire someone to make a bedika. If a person isn't bekoyach to make two bedikas. Generally, people who have many residences are not interested in crawling on the floor and getting behind all the places, the makom shemachnis and mechametz. But they should get someone else, because maybe it would be a nice thing if there would be a professional boit ke chometz for hire. The problem is that people don't want someone else snooping around their house, their closets, their drawers. But ideally, that's what should be done. They should be boit ke chometz in their own house. And if they're sick and old, then they should find some way to rent out the house or sell it legally. Maybe there could be some real estate agents who could benefit those who have to sell their house by, charging some money and making a sale that's valid.
Well, the Cholapoch is rented, as Rav Bolch
right.
said.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Rav Shechter, I heard...
And give the... Make the serious mafteach to the guy. Or the Rav who does the job of renting it to the guy.
Okay, Rav Shechter, someone asked... I've heard that some people do not sell their chametz, or that they do not sell some types of chametz. Can you please explain? Should one be strict about this when possible? And what definition should one use regarding chametz gomo?
Rabbi Belsky mentioned earlier that our institution in Chiras Chametz started around the middle of the 1800s. Years ago, they never sold any chametz. What shaykh, you're not going to leave a loaf of bread over Pesach, it'll get stale. Today, in recent years, we have refrigerators and freezers, so it's what to discuss. So the...
whiskey.
And whiskey can last for a long time. In the Tosefta, the only case you have about Mechiras chametz is the Jews traveling on a boat, and they have no kosher kitchen on the boat, and the Jew carries all the food with him for a month or 2 months. So he has the chametz, if he's going to throw it over into the river, he's not into the ocean, he's not going to have any food to eat. So such a big shas atchak, so the Tosefta says you sell the chametz to one of the non-Jews on the boat, and then you buy it back after Pesach. In the middle 1800s, there were many Jewish farmers, and the practice was that they used to sell the chametz to the goyish next door neighbor. So if they used to feed chametz to the cows, or to the behemoths. So if they would ask the next door neighbor to feed my cows chametz, so then I'm getting hanor from chametz. They used to sell the cow with the chametz and give the goyish neighbor instructions, make sure you feed my behemoth's chametz. So that was a big shaila, whether that's permissible or not. So the Nesivis was the one who said that it's permissible. And we have in the tshuvas of the Nesivis in the Nachlas Yankov, I think the first tshuva he sent to the Rav from Buchach. The Rav had a taina against the Nesivis that the Yerushalmi says... in Maseches Maaseh Sheni, the only time you're permitted to do Ha'arameh is by pidyon ma'aseh sheni to be poydeh without chomesh. That's how the parak begins there. Ketzed ma'arim ma'aseh ma'aseh sheni levdosa b'lo chomesh. So the Yerushalmi says that's the only case where we allow harama. Harama means a legal fiction. In normal course of events, let's say, I'm not in the business, I don't have a grocery store, I don't sell spaghetti, I don't sell cookies, I have cookies in my home and I eat them. Whatever gets spoiled, I throw it out in the garbage. I don't normally sell merchandise to a non-Jew. So this is really a legal fiction over here. It's legal, but it's a legal fiction. It's harama. So the Bechatcher of Taina, that the Yerushalmi says the only time we permit harama is by pidyon ma'aseh sheni to save yourself adding on the chomesh. So he tainted against it, but Chacha Rav tainted against the institution of mechiras chametz. Not acceptable. You should never do mechiras chametz. Whatever chametz you have, you should destroy it, throw it out in the garbage, or be mafgrit, leave it in the street. Don't sell it and buy it back after Pesach. And the Nesivis wrote him back, you can do whatever you want. My psak was accepted by all the rabbanim in Eastern Europe, that we don't follow that Yerushalmi and Shoin, we allow mechiras chametz. So that was the generally accepted opinion. There was a minority opinion. The Tvor Shor was of the opinion, the Pchor Shor was of the opinion that based on the Gemara in the end of Shabbos, that we only allow Harama, these kind of legal fictions, with respect to Dinim Derabbanan, not with respect to Dinim Deraisa. That's what the Gemara says in the end of Shabbos. But in the context of the Gemara, the word Harama doesn't really mean a legal fiction. It means a totally different thing there. But that's what the Bechor Shor quotes from the Gemara. So based on that, many have the practice that on chometz bien, on chometz, let's say cookies or bread, the cake, those kind of things are real spaghetti, or any food where the chometz ingredient, where the flour is more than 50%. So that's considered chometz bien. So chometz bien, where there's bal yirod, deraisa, so the Bechor Shor wouldn't permit harama. But if you have taruvas chometz means where the flour, the grain flour component is less than 50%, so it's taruvas chametz. So true, the Gemara says you're not allowed to eat taruvas chametz on Pesach and there's bal yeruah, but the Rabbi Natam, one version Rabbi Natam has it, that on taruvas chametz the bal yeruah is only the Rabban. So since you're only dealing with the Nisa bal yeruah, the Rabbanon, so that's why even with the chumra of the Bechor Shor, there's room to be makel to allow the harama of selling chametz. So Rav Soloveitchik always used to encourage the Balabatim to be machmer about that. I was very surprised. He every year he would tell the Balabatim, Boston and in New York, rather he would give public shurim, they should try to avoid selling chametz bien, unless they have a grocery store. They have no choice. So then he said, you should make a separate shtar mechira. You shouldn't just include it in the regular shtar mechira where the rabbi sells all the chametz from all the 300 families from the shul. You should make a separate shtar mechira. But if a balabas has privately owned chametz, he doesn't have a store. So he encouraged even the balabatim that they should dispose of all the chametz bien. They should only rely on mechiras chametz with respect to tarubas chametz. I visited once by the Boston Rebbe in Boston, the son of the one who just passed away. So he was once talking to me that people say that Rabbi Soloveitchik held like the Bechatcherov, that you're not allowed to rely on mechiras chametz. So he says it's not true. That Rabbi Soloveitchik never did mechiras chametz. So he always used to come to his father, Olam HaShalom, to ask his father to sell the chametz for him. So he says he has all the shtar mechira from the last 30 years of Rabbi Soloveitchik's life that he used to sign that the Boston Rebbe should sell the chametz for him. He just insisted you shouldn't sell chametz bien. When Balabatim would ask, what about schnapps? Is that considered chametz bien? So sometimes he would say, Besser nicht zu fragen, it's better not to ask, because there's a famous Tshuvas Pnei Yeshua. The Pnei Yeshua is all the opinion that schnapps is considered chametz bien. Some poskim hold that schnapps is, even schnapps from grain is kosher lePesach because it's distilled. Because once you evaporate it, it turns into steam, so then you can't say that it's not edible. It's not Roi L'Achil as anything. It's not food. It's a gas. So even after you distill it and it turns back into liquid, so some poskim say that that's Zeir B'Alma, that you can eat chametz dikah schnapps on Pesach. That's obviously not the accepted opinion. So some are of the opinion, many poskim are of the opinion, that schnapps, even if you say it's chametz dik, even though we assume it's chametz dik, it's not considered chametz bien. So Rav Soloveitchik used to say that you should be machmer unless you have a liquor shop. He used to say you should be machmer not to sell your schnapps either. You should dispose of it legamai.
So in other words, there's room to be mekel as far as schnapps.
Different opinions. The Pashtus is
that also only because in questions that come up including here at the OU, in regard of distribution. The distributor is a yid. So, according to what Rav Shechter just said, one could be makel.
Rav Chaim Moshe has a tshuva where he discusses a practice in Europe where religious Jews who were very careful about kashrus would drink regular brandy, non-Jewish brandy.
Brandy, wine,
we
brandy.
Know, is made from wine. Made from wine, so it's tam yenum. So how can they drink wine or cognac? They would drink cognac or brandy. So he says they rely on the opinion, this opinion that zeh bi'alma is mutter by the isurim de rabbanan. That since it's evaporated and it turns into gas, even though it's converted back, when you cool it off, it's converted back into water, so there is an opinion that any treif of food that evaporates and then you make it back into a liquid food is mutter. So even though we don't accept that with respect to chametz, we don't drink chametz, zikah, schnapps on Pesach, but there were those who were mekel on stam yenim. Stam yenim is only an isa derabbanon, so he said he used to be mekel on an isa derabbanon. But he says it's not really right to be mekel. Even on dinim derabbanon, it's not right to be mekel. But that's what some poskim say. With respect to possessing the schnapps on Pesach, by your words in isa deraisa, so then we say we don't rely on the heter of zeh b'yam. With respect to chametz over all of our Pesach, some poskim say maybe there's room to be mekel. It's a big shas hatrak. Let's say a liquor shop forgot to sell all of his schnapps. It's going to lose hundreds of thousands of dollars. So some of the poskim say there's room to be mekel.
Even a bigger hefset in terms of the distributors, if the distributors didn't sell.
Mm-hmm. So there are those who are mekel.
Historically, there's a reason why more people were mekel by schnapps than by anything else, is because originally the ones who sold schnapps were the Jewish innkeepers throughout Europe. There were hundreds and hundreds of innkeepers, and their main stock in trade was schnapps. And therefore they couldn't sell it. They had huge amounts of barrels of schnapps, and they had to use it all year long for the clientele, which was mostly non-Jewish. And because of that, the first things that were sold were the whiskeys held by the Jewish innkeepers. So that's why they were treated like grocers who could just find it impossible to... But then again, if a person has, 100 bottles of schnapps, a private housekeeper who fancies himself a connoisseur and gets all kinds of expensive liquors, he still doesn't become an innkeeper. But these things have a tendency to grow and grow and grow. So I said before, the transition of having three ways of preventing the Yisr of Tashbisu, Bittel, Bedike, and Mechir, and it's so ingrained today that people they sell the Blias and the Kelim, Mohammed and Nidbak the Kelim. In my opinion, it throws a serious question on the entire Mechir. Because it's like saying kini atva chamor. You can't have a mechira which is part fictional, real fictional, not legal fiction, but a mechira which is just fictional. There's no way you could sell blias and kelim. It doesn't exist, such a kind of mechira. And I'll tell you on a personal note, I've never sold chametz in my house, but when I had a few items which I felt I just couldn't get rid of, medication and these things, I put it in the box and carried it to a Goyish neighbor and opened it up and showed him what he has, a few small items, and he would pay me money for it, $20 or whatever, and there it is, and I intend to do the same thing, Be'ezus Hashem, this year. It's just the thing that bothered me most about the Mechira's Chometz is the sort of inclusion of Mechira as being a third leg to the to Bedik and Bittel, and a method of getting rid of Tashbisu, which it never was intended to become.
Ravelsky, you want to also comment about stocks, shares in chametz companies, whether they need to be sold?
Well, the Roiv of the world and Poiskim followed Moshe's Psak and many, many Poiskim beforehand that held that when a person just owns a share of stock in a publicly held company, so he doesn't own the assets of the company. It's a financial investment, just a way to make money, but there's no ownership of assets, and therefore he doesn't own the chametz. the only people who are considered owners of the property of the company, the assets, are the ones who have, in addition to ownership of stock, they wield an influence in the company, either because they sit on the board of directors and are officers who could make decisions or influence decisions in the company, or because they own so much stock that whatever they say will be considered binding on the other members because everybody's fearful of their influence since they own 40-50% of the company. But Moshe was once asked about someone who owns 30% of the company. He says, yep, that makes a person into an owner. They're considered to be, even though a stock is a share in a legal entity which doesn't exist. It's an invention. A company, a corporation, that's a body that is just a theoretical body. The corporation owns the assets, but the owner of the stock doesn't own the assets. He owns the share of the corporation. If he has such an influence in the ownership of the stock, or being an officer and a director and so on and so forth, and that he actually makes decisions involving the assets of the company, Moshe said that that's considered ownership of assets as well, and he shouldn't take any chances. And this opinion has been accepted by many, many rabbonim. I've heard it from Poskim during the lifetime of the Moshe and since then, and it really could be traced back to Tshuvas written over, quite a few years before that.
I think this question was covered, but I'll just, in honor of our chaverim in Eretz Yisrael who are listening in, this shaila came in from Eretz Yisrael. I made Aliyah 3.5 years ago, and now I'm told, Rav Shechter, that in Israel the preferred way is to make sure all chametz is out of the apartment instead of selling it, which is done in the diaspora, he says. I prefer not to get rid of the chametz, but to sell it as I've done in the past. He asks how the OU in Israel handles this. I don't know how the OU in Israel handles this, but this is the question. If the sale should not take place and one disposes of the chametz, would that be the preferred way?
I'm not familiar with the fact that in Eretz Yisrael there's such a minig. If there is such a community where there is such a minig, so that he should follow the minig. If he plans to live there permanently, he should not rely on chiras chametz. Okay. They're following the Bechachara, they're following the B'chorshar, that you shouldn't not sell any chametz, and not sell chametz b'yen. Okay.
Okay. In terms of the practical, technical aspects of Mechiras Chametz of Shechter, does there need to be a kinyan, or can I fax the Mechiras Chametz to my rabbi? And also, for the sake of the rabbis, we'll add his additional question. He asked, do I have to pay the rabbi to act as my agent?
I think there may be a misunderstanding in the premise of the question. A lot of people think that when they sell the chametz to the rabbi, they're selling the chametz to the rabbi. They're not selling.
Hopefully
the
not.
Rabbi. We're appointing the rabbi as the shliach to sell the chametz for us to the non-Jew. So now the question should be worded: do you need a kinyan when you appoint the rabbi as a shliach? So the Rambam writes that strictly speaking, a kinyan is not necessary, but the minig is that one makes a kinyan whenever you appoint a shliach, even when a man appoints a shliach to give a get to his wife. Also, the Rambam writes, and that's the common practice, that the man makes a kinyan with the shliach. Shliach gives the husband a handkerchief, in exchange for which the husband gives over the right of attorney, the right to divorce his wife, or the right to sell the chametz to him. So the Rambam writes that the Rambam first writes that a kinyan is not necessary when you appoint a shliach. And it doesn't make any sense, but then he does justify it. He says it does make sense. So the Chazon Ish and his brother-in-law, the Stipler, were of the practice that when they appointed the rabbi, they didn't sell chametz. They used to go to a different rabbi to sell the chametz for them. So when they would appoint the rabbi as a shliach, on principle, they would not make a kinyan with the rabbi because the Rambam says that it's a minik shtus. The Rambam says that it doesn't make any sense. Everybody else assumes that the Rambam first starts off by saying that ain't sichem kinyan, ain't the kinyan behem tam, it doesn't make any sense, but then he justifies it. He explains why it does make sense. So that's why the common practice is that when we appoint the rabbi as a shliach, we do make a kinyan with the rabbi. The rabbi gives a handkerchief. That's a kinyan suitor. It's Caleb Shulkina. The rabbi is acquiring the right of attorney. He has the right not to sell my chometz. So that's the meaning that you do make a kinyan. If you just fax to the rabbi a statement that you appoint him as a shliach, so you're not in fulfillment of this meaning that if you hold that it's not a minig shtus. Chazan Yishal is a minig shtus, and he on purpose didn't make the kinyan. But the rest of the world assumes that the Rambam justified the minig. So you should make the kinyan. Rav Soloveitchik once mentioned that every rabbi has a problem, that as he's about to sell a chometz to the Nochri, someone's going to call him up on the telephone and say, Rabbi, I forgot to come to you to make the kinyan to ask you to sell a chometz for me. So if it's over the telephone, you can't make a kinyan suitor. So what can you do? So the Pashto says, you forgo the kinyan suitor. So Rav Soloveitchik explained how it's possible to make a kinyan suitor over the telephone. So he said, one way is to ask the balabos, where are you? Are you in an office where there's another Jew there? So if there's another Jew, ask the other Jew to give his handkerchief to you as representing me. That's what we do all the time by chasana. The kala doesn't give her handkerchief to the chasan to be koine the tosefes ksuba. The rabbi or the witnesses give a handkerchief to the chasan, and they represent the kala. So ask another Jew who's there to give you a handkerchief as representing the rabbi. Or if there's no other Jew there, to make the kinyan suder ayudei, what we call kinyan abeknaini. Someone else gives on my behalf. Have the balabos say over the telephone, Rabbi, I'm appointing you as a shliach with my full heart, and I really mean it, and I'm not kidding around. So the Rambam writes, the Rambam justifies the minhag to make a kinyan when you appoint the rabbi as a shliach to sell a chometz. So he says the idea behind the kinyan is to demonstrate that you really mean this b'lev shalom, b'lev gomar marti b'gamarti dover zeh. So if the person says orally, I appoint you as a shliach, and I really mean it, and I'm not kidding around, and it's with my full heart, then the Rambam says there's no need already for the minig. Then you don't need the kinyan suitor. So Rav Soloveitchik suggested if a balabos calls on the telephone, you should have him add on that sentence. So then you're not in violation of the minig. He thought that it was a good minig. That's the common practice. I remember Rabbi Breuer Zechon Levracha, when the balabatim had come to sell chometz, they would appoint him as a shliach, so he would give him the bottom of his kapota. Instead of giving a handkerchief, he would give his kapota. The reason for that, huh? The handkerchief, the din is that gimel al gimel etzpo is 3 by 3 inches. If I give part of a handkerchief and I gave 3 by 3, so that's good enough. So Rabbi Yitzchak Chanan has a tshuva with someone, one of the rabbanim asked him, that the halacha says that a piece of cloth, gimel al gimel, 3 inches by 3 inches, is considered a beggin and it's makabel tumah. That's only if it's tzemer or pishtim, and the handkerchiefs are made from cotton, they're not made from tzemer. So if this kohanim is asked, what if you give a handkerchief that's made for cotton, is gimel al gimel as boy is good enough? So he says yes, and he quotes a line in a Tosfos in the last parak in Bava Basra, mamash a needle in a haystack, that Tosfos writes that gimel al gimel is good even though it's not tzemer or pishtim, even though it's not makabel tumah. So there were those who used to be machmer on that. So Rabbi Breuer used to wear a woolen kapota. So he used to give the corner of the kapota, that's wool, that was better than the gimel al gimel etz bois of the handkerchief that's made from cotton. I think could be now that all the kapotas are not made from wool. I don't know, we got to find out. Could be that you gain nothing by using a kapota now if it's not made from wool. But the common practice is that the rabbi always makes a kabbalas kinyan when they appoint him as the shliach to sell the chometz to the nochri.
What about the last part as to whether or not there is any obligation to pay the rabbi to act as the agent?
Strictly speaking, there is no obligation. Rab Chaim Moyza has another tshuva where he discusses that practice. The tshuva is about shalachmanis. When you send someone to deliver shalachmanis, do you have the right to rely on the ruba deleisakamon, the likelihood that chazoka shaliachos shlichusa, that if you ask a person to take care of something for you and he says he's going to take care of it, can you rely on him or not? So the Gemara in Erevin comes to the conclusion that if it's an issue deraisa, you cannot rely on chazaka shliachos shlichusoi. If it's only an issue derabanan, you may rely on the chazaka. So Rav Chaim Moshe discusses what's the story of shalachmanis. Shalachmanis is not deraisa, but it's diri kabbalah. It's mentioned in Tanakh, mentioned Megillah Esther. So in the middle of that shuva, he says that a question: how can I rely? How can the 300 families rely on the rabbi that is selling the chometz? Valyiru is a din deraisa. And with respect to dinam derais, you're not supposed to rely on the chazaka shlichos shlichusai. So he says, well, the Gemara says there in Erevin, let's say it's bezna hagadol, who's taking care of something. There's now God will sing to it that the Kohanim and the Beis HaMikdash are being makriv the Karmen Minchas HaOmer. So the Mishnah says that all over the world, once it's already noontime, Chatzos on the first day, Chol Hamoed Pesach in Yerushalayim, so be yodua that the Beis HaMikdash took care of it, that the Minchas HaOmer was brought, so everyone all over the world is permitted to eat the Chodosh. So the Gemara says, why? Because the Beis HaMikdash is very reliable. Whenever it's a very reliable individual, then you have the right to rely on Chazok as Shliachos or Shluchus, even with respect to Adin Deraisa. So Rav Chaim Moshe suggests, and not Shuva, maybe that's why the Minig developed, that the Balabatim give some money to the rabbi to sell a chometz for them. If he does the sell a chometz, he has to give back the money. So this will encourage him. The rabbi is more reliable than most people, and if you give him a few dollars, then it's even more, he feels even more responsible to make sure that he sells a chometz. Is maybe that strengthens the chazok of shlichos or shlichus. That was the common practice, that the balabatim would give the rabbi a few dollars to sell a chametz on their behalf, but strictly speaking, it's not really necessary.
There are those who said that because the rabbi's incomes were so limited that the mechias chametz geld supplemented their...
In Europe?
Yeah, socioeconomic conditions. One of our friends asked regarding mechias chametz, if she needs to, she wants to know whether pickles, mayonnaise, ketchup, horseradish, v'chadome have to be sold with the chametz, or can she put them in a bag and store them separately in the refrigerator somewhere, or where they would be kept?
A lot of these products have chametz ingredients, yes, so you have to sell it. You can't just, if you just have kidneys, if you have beans, or if you have corn on the cob, so that's not the chametz, that's only kidneys. So kidneys, the Ashkenaz, we don't eat it, but we don't have to sell it. But these products do have some taruvas chametz. They could possibly have a mixture of chametz, so that you have to sell. You know, according to Rabbi Natam, it could be that it's only bal yirah derabbanan, but still it's going to be at least a bal yirah.
Rabelsky, we come back to issues relating to distributors. I've heard rumors, the questioner wrote us, of Jewish-owned distributors which supply the main grocers across the country with a large percentage of chametz food. Must one be concerned with this when purchasing chametz after Pesach? And if so, could you please provide some guidelines and direction, as it is very hard to know if a certain product was provided to the stores from a Jewish distributor?
There are major distributors of food which are Jewish-owned, and especially in the Northeast, but it's throughout the country. And they sell chametz during Pesach to goyim, to all kinds of grocery stores. I have an Arab store across the street. They're fine people, good neighbors. throughout Pesach, there's Cresdale and White Rose, Jewish distributors who deliver orders to that store on Pesach. People think that they could go to a non-Jewish store after Pesach and buy for a couple of weeks without being afraid of Chametz Shavuot over Pesach. Only by a Jewish store is there such a fear. But definitely in the New York area, it's roiv of the... of the distributors are Jewish. The largest distributor of all, CNS, is Cohen. That's what the C stands for. They're the ones who supply the major stores, Walmart, and so on. A lot of that is chametz that's purchased on Pesach.
In other words, explain to our listeners what halacha does a distributor have.
Well, the distributor buys from the manufacturer, and everything that the manufacturer sells to him becomes his own personal property. And then he sells to stores, to small stores. There's no way that the storekeeper could buy from Kellogg's their cereal. Kellogg's cereals are sold in rail cars. In dozens of rail cars, the long trains where they were carried from the factory to the east and to the west. These places can't possibly deal with small stores, but they sell to distributors, and the distributor has huge warehouses, and they in turn have trucks that go to the smaller stores. This is the way it has to be done. Between the manufacturer and the small retailer, even the large retailer, there has to be there have to be distributors. And the distributors own the product during the time that it comes into their property. They buy it like any buyer, and they sell it like any seller. And if they buy chametz on Pesach, they could make all the shtar mechiras in the world before Pesach. And many of them do. They have very friendly rabbonim who arrange for shtar mechiras with all kinds of lashonis. Whether they're valid or not valid is to be questioned. But that's vaday. It's absolutely certain that what they buy on Pesach was not sold to anybody. It becomes their property, and they sell it to the goy. And it's chomish over of a Pesach. So the best thing is to buy from Jewish stores who sold their chomish before Pesach and kept it all locked up. L'chol ha'pachas, there was a valid mechir. I've heard that Rav Sonnenfeld in Yerushalayim would get up and announce that there's nothing to be gained by going to the Arab stores and buying from them after Pesach, and causing a hefset to Jewish storekeepers who followed the accepted minig and sold their chometz and didn't touch it, and to them it was bal yiro bal yimotze. They had nothing to do with it. It was locked up and out of their interest and out of their property. And why go to a guy who may be buying chometz from Eden? We don't know where he gets his chometz from.
So part of the same question the gentleman asked, given all the confusion about who the distributors are they Jewish or not, and when they receive their chometz, is it better for me to purchase all my chometz needs for after Pesach, before Pesach, and then sell my chometz to be sure I have what to eat after Pesach?
Yeah. I would suggest that anyone who wants to find these things out, and everyone should, unless they have a local store where they could be certain that it's under the supervision of a rov and they could be certain that it was done properly, they should call up Rabbi Gerstin at the OU, and he'll send them a pamphlet which was put together by Rabbi Herman, the expert on Chodesh, of which distributors and which wholesalers have Jewish ownership, and then they'll know where to buy their chometz in a few weeks following Pesach. After Lag BaOmer or so, it's almost certain, or L'chol HaPachas, it's a roiv, that the food that they sell came through a distributor who bought that food after Pesach. Because there's a very quick turnover by the distributors. It lasts 2 weeks and at most 3 weeks. So if it was bought after Pesach, then it would reach the retailers after Lag BaOmer. It's pretty safe. Until then, one should buy from Jewish-owned stores or whatever it is, that the places that you can be certain have a stuff that wasn't owned by Yidden on Pesach. It's a very difficult thing because the economy is very complicated. Products go through a number of hands before they reach the consumer.
So that was really the next question. How long must I wait to purchase bread, pasta, cereal, crackers, and other chametz items in a Jewish-owned store that was selling chametz on Pesach? Belsky said, by Lag BaOmer, one could assume that one could buy.
But you can't, if you're living in a section where there's no reliable store that you could buy from, bread, you know, doesn't last for a long time. Bread is baked on the day that it's sold, unless it's some kind of bread that's preserved, some long-lasting bread. But people like to buy fresh bread, so you could assume it was baked within the last day or two at most. But you have to really put a little effort into making sure that what you buy after Pesach should be from stores which... I have to say these things to an audience that's listening here and doesn't have the convenience that we have here in the city with this. so many alternatives available. Out of town, there are people who just have nowhere to buy their bread except in the stores. But they should get information, and the local rabbonim should try to find out which stores don't buy from Jewish distributors over Pesach, or at least after Pesach, immediately after Pesach. The distributors are still selling chametz that they bought on Pesach for a couple of weeks after Pesach. They should.
In other words, what needs to be clarified here, particularly for out of town, is that even if there are many communities where the rabbonim are careful that the supermarkets, Jewish owned, sell their chametz and so forth, but that doesn't help as far as the distributor.
Right.
That needs to be made clear.
And if the supermarket sells the chametz, they may be buying chametz the entire Pesach, from beginning to end, every single day. They'll buy new chametz and they'll be selling it. And all the shtar mechiras in the world can't do anything about that kind of chametz.
What about the suggestion Rabbi Yisrafim mentioned before? Maybe if a person lives out of town and he doesn't have a Jewish store available where we can rely that they sell the chametz, maybe I should buy a lot of, the private person should buy a ton of chametz and cereals and so on, cookies, and put it away and sell it to the guy, and then after Pesach buy it back. Does that make sense?
Make an extra special mechira. Go to a Rav who's knowledgeable and make a valid mechira. That should be legal.
Okay, one more question that came in just a minute ago regarding chametz, buying of chametz and so forth. I know some people that are careful to only purchase deodorants and shampoos according to a certain list, he writes. I don't know any dog that would eat, spray, or roll on. Is there any basis for this chumrah, Ravelsky?
The Moshe Zatzal had said in the tshuva that perhaps alcohols that are denatured, SD alcohol, especially denatured alcohol, even though they have a horrible taste, it's so awful that if you put it on your tongue, you have to recover for about 20 minutes to be able to get rid of the awful taste and smell. But somebody who's, you know, thirsty for alcohol, a shikr, and can't find any material to fulfill his craving and his need, might take anything that has some significant percentage of alcohol and drink it down. So Moshe said, because of that, it may not be called the nifsal. I think the logic behind it is that who in the world would want to drink so much alcohol anyway? It must be a shikr who has a craving for alcohol. And so for such kind of people, it's not nifsal. It is a sfora. However, the stuff that's made into shampoos, it's nifsal for many reasons, not just because of the nature of the alcohol. It refers only to a limited group of products that could possibly provide satisfaction for the alcoholic. But for most of these things, wouldn't give any satisfaction at all. I don't believe so, but I can tell you from personal experience.
We have to ask a real shikr.
Mm-hmm.
Have they ever been asked? One question about Tainis Bechoros, various minhagim that are cited in Achronim. This person asks, may one make a siyum and one mesecht of Mishnayos for Tainis Bechoros? Is there any minimal amount that one must learn, Rav Shechter?
I think it's usually assumed that if you're making a siyum on a Gemara, one mesichta is enough, even though it's a very tiny mesichta, like Maseches Tamid. But if you're making a siyum on Mishnayos, traditionally we assume it should be a Seder of Mishnayos.
Okay, we're going to switch gears to Inyone Seder and Haggadah for the time that we have left. Is there a Hidur of Belsky to use non-Mevushal wine? If yes, does it matter if the non-Mevushal wine started as a juice that could not ferment because they added chemicals to stop the natural fermentation in order to have a subsequent controlled fermentation?
Well, there's two separate shilas. One is that, is there a hiddur in having non-mavushal wine. There's definitely a hiddur. In Shulchan Aruch it says that you could make hiddush on wine that's mavushal and wine that has sugar. And if you prefer to make it on white wine rather than red wine. But there are shoinim that say that you should make it bedafka on red wine, for instance. The Ramban, or the Rambam says that you can't make it on wine that has any sugar added to it, or wine that's mavushal. So even though halacha l'maisa, we pass on against these three preferences, but it's definitely a hidur, and a preference to have wine that's not mavushal, that's red, that has no sugar added to it. If someone, you know, has people who may cause the wine to become osir through pouring it at his table, so he probably would find it much more convenient to carry wine that's mavushal, so that there shouldn't be any question of samyenam by the handling of the wine. Now, what was the? There was another part of the question.
Grape juice.
Yeah. As far as grape juice, which had an additive before it, now there's a Gemara in Baba Basra that says that a certain kind of wine is possible for kiddush and for the mizbeach, and that wine is wine that the Rashbam is masbir that it's wine that won't turn into, it's grape juice rather that won't turn into wine. So the grape juice is posel. It's garua, it won't turn into wine, naturally. Therefore, it can't be used for kiddush, it can't be used for the mizbeach. Although wine should be fermented, preferably for the mizbeach. But once it can't turn into wine, so it's nifso. It's not the proper grape juice, and it can't be used for wine. Rav Henkin Zatzal wrote in his Sefer in the Eidus L'Yisroel, in the countries that included in the Eidus L'Yisroel. So Rav Henkin wrote that the wine therefore shouldn't be used for Kiddush because of that Rashbam. Why? Because today they take grape juice and they put an additive in it to either prevent it from fermenting or to kill the yeast. They cook it so that the yeast should be dead. That's what Rav Henkin held. And Rav Henkin, you know, was the major poisik b'shaita in America and one of the major poisim in the world. And of course, his opinion is very, very important to us. There's others who disagreed and who held that when the Gemara speaks about grape juice that can't ferment and can't turn into wine, it's because of the chisorin, because the giroyin of the grape juice. Because of that chisorin, so it's considered low quality, and it's improper, and it's not the type of juice that the Torah, that Chazal accepted to be considered yayin, and even if it's turned into wine, it's yayin garua. The grape juice that we have, that add the sulfites, or that they cook and kill the yeast, they don't become garua. They're the highest quality. They do it for a reason. The reason is so that they should add their own yeast so they could standardize the wine and have the same taste and the same level of alcohol, because common wines, not very high-class wines, but common wines, are sold to people who expect to have the same taste that they're used to. So they want to standardize the wine. So therefore they stop it from fermenting. And they don't want it to ferment too much, even when it does ferment. And so they put retardants and they cook it and they kill the yeast. They don't make any chisorin in it. It's the same grape juice. It's the perfect, it's the top quality. There's absolutely no chisorin in it. From the mashmois of the entire sugi in Baba Basra, it's the pashtus is, the simple pshat is that the only reason for saying that such grape juice that can turn into wine is possible is because of the chisorin, because it's spoiled. This wine is definitely not spoiled. In fact, it could be turned into grape juice, because all they have to do is insert the yeast, and that's the way they manufacture it. They take the juice and they kill the yeast that's found in the juice, because that yeast varies. That's why there's vintage wine. Some wines are better, some wines are worse, because of the natural condition of the grape from year to year. Some yeast is one kind of yeast, is more yeast, less yeast, and many other qualities. And they want to standardize it, but it's still absolutely the same quality and has the same ability to ferment and turn into wine, except that you have to air the yeast and make it turn into wine. And that's what they do. That's 90% of the wine that's commonly sold. And the prevailing opinion is that there's no chisorin in that wine. It may be, it probably was mavushal, because otherwise they couldn't kill the yeast.
Yeah. Rabelsky, someone also asked, Bosa Inyan, what is the smallest percentage of alcohol that would be acceptable as wine for Dalet Kosos?
Well, the smallest percentage of alcohol, first of all, it's kosher even without any alcohol at all. But Moshe Tainid, that the Gemara says that when you weren't moiseig the wine properly, according to the way they did in those days, they had water and so on. So that's called you're not yoise cheres, right? Big machlokes is showing them exactly what cheres means, but sof kol sof yidei yayin yotze yidei cheres lo yotze shosei yayin chai. That's what yayin chai means, yayin that's not mozug. So Moshe said that wine that has grape juice that has no alcohol in it at all is also yidei cheres lo yotze, because the cheres is achieved by the high that the alcohol gives it, the feeling of the special enjoyment that you get from wine. It's not by drinking grape juice. The enjoyment of grape juice is probably no different than apple juice or oranges, but it's the alcohol in the wine that gives it the special pleasure. So that's the cheres. That's what the Moshe held. And so there has to be some wine, some alcohol, for the mitzvah min hamufcher. So there should be the cheres, like the Rashbam learns that it's Rashi also mitzvah min hamufcher. Okay. The Yamam learns differently. Arba kois avor kois asiktu chachamim mishum cheres. Now, what's the amount of alcohol? The Rambam learns that the person should, in those days when they added water and they were moizig, the koises, which means to blend it with water. So, how much water should they blend? He says, kipi das ha-shoise. Each person has his own preference. The Gemara tells about one who put in two pots or three pots of water to the wine. Different pots according to their preference. So he says you should mix it with as much water, kipi das ha-shoise. But let's just take what they had in those days. The alcohol, natural alcohol in the wine, is never more than 14%. Because after 14%, the yeast dies, and it's impossible it has to be distilled for it to have more than 14%. So truly in those days, they had no more than 14%. They say in those days the wine was stronger, that means it had a stronger flavor. And to water down the flavor, they would put in water. Perhaps there are wines with a very strong flavor that taste very bad if they don't water a little dilute. But the alcohol was 14%, and if they put in three parts of water to one part of wine, like most Moisgim did in those days, so then there was 3.5%. That's what you do. It's a quarter of the amount of wine in the drink. A quarter of 14 is 3.5%. So the Kal wine, which they sell all over the place, which has 3.5%, is definitely not insufficient. It wasn't insufficient in the time of the Gemara. However, a person who was used to drinking some higher percentage of alcohol, and on Pesach by night he drinks a lower percentage, he's not experiencing the cheres from the wine that he's used to. To him, the das ha-shoise is not being served by the 3.5%. But 3.5%.
But all year he doesn't drink Dalet Kosos. He may just drink one.
Right, but all year when he drinks wine, he feels the high and the cheres of wine. That, when he has 12% or 10% or 40%, whatever it is, but not 3.5%. And Pesach by night, he's missing the element of cheres according to the way he feels throughout the year. The das or choice is not served. Okay.
But what if for him the element of cheres that gives him the high will make him fashlofen, will make him not able to fully fulfill all the mitzvahs, to say the Haggadah properly?
So then he'll have to, you know, make some happy compromise. There's a lot of times when you need to do a number of things and you can't do all of it. So it's more important to stay up. We were mechala koyes ve'goyzim to the children, kadesh le'yishnu. The Omer Haggadah, the leader of the Seder, whose presence is so important that the Seder should surely not be falling asleep in his very comfortable Haseba chair. So it would be for a person like that. Definitely he should drink a lower alcohol, and he should try to be margish the cheres by making a better Haseba and so on.
Rav Shechter, we'll go to some inyonei Haggadah. What parts of the Haggadah can be omitted if a young child is falling asleep, or if perhaps non-frum attendees might get bored or are already bored? Alternatively, can any part of the Haggadah be said in English to help keep the interest?
In English says in Shulchan Aruch. In Shulchan Aruch they quote there were Bali Hataisis who lived in England, and their wives and their children didn't understand Hebrew, so they said the Haggadah in English. If those who live in Flatbush and their wives and their children only understand Yiddish, so then they have to say in Yiddish or whatever language they understand. Which parts of the Haggadah can be left out? Well, Echad Meyodea, everything after Nirtzeh can be left out. You can leave out all the things at the end. You can leave out. That's if you want to skip things from before. That's not so easy. The manashtani you have to say. That says in the Mishnah. Then the Mishnah says you have to be maschot begnusim misayim b'shvach. So the Gemara has two versions of what that's referring to. So we do both. We do Rav and Shmo. So we say avadam hayinu lefar b'mitzrayim. Then we have in Tchilo Abdel B'Dezara Hoya Aveseinu. Those are the two versions of what the Mishnah requires. I don't think it would be the Yikuvah. Let's say if you would leave out Maisa Rab Lezer Rab Yeshua Babo Abonim Kenegar Abo Abonim Dibetah, I don't think you have to say that. Baruch HaMokam Baruch Hu, that you really should say. And if people don't understand the Hebrew, you should translate that. Some of the Rishonim understand that that's like a Birchas HaTorah on the reciting of the mitzvah of CPCS Mitzrayim. Yochel Merosh Chodesh, that you can leave out. Let's see, what else? Tzeil Aman, Ma'bi Gishlov and Aramid, that's an important part. You're reciting the psukim of Arami Ovid Ovi and interpreting, so that the Mishnah says that's really required. What else? When you give the Tzach Adash Bachav, that you can probably leave out. That's not Miakiv Dayena, you can leave out. The Esamakis, that you can leave out. Rabbi Gamliel HaYoyimah, that's the most important thing.
That's the
Ika. Pesach Matzah Mora, that's the Ika, yeah.
That's the answer to the Fear Kashas.
The Manishtana.
That's
the main part.
That also relates to a question, the main part. People say the women should then be at the table. Okay, somebody asks, I'm a mother who needs to tend to my children and to serve food during the Seder. Which part of the Haggadah must I be sure not to miss? And which parts can I miss if necessary? So the parts can miss the necessary thing, Rav Shechter already listed.
The Gemara tells us that just like by Kiddush and Havdalah, you can have one person recite the Kiddush and everybody pays attention in their Yotzeh, which Shemer Koina. So the Gemara says the same was true regarding Sipi Yitzis Mitzrayim. They used to have one person recite the Haggadah, and everybody else would listen to the Yotzeh. So the women who are in the kitchen, if the husband is going to say the Haggadah out loud and the wife understands Hebrew, most of the women today do understand Hebrew, or if they don't understand Hebrew, the husband should translate into English. If the wife is listening in the kitchen, it's also good. It's not necessary that she says everything herself. The husband can be mitzi his wife at the reciting of the whole Haggadah.
So Taka, somebody asked, indeed, in different words, in my family, our grandfather leads the Seder and reads everything, we just listen. Is this the preferred way? How much should we allow our children time to present their Seder narratives from the many sheets that they receive in school?
Is it the preferred way? By Kiddush, there's a question whether it's preferred. The Vilna Gaon says it's preferred that one person should recite Kiddush and everyone should be Yotzei. That's based on Beroivam Haris Melach. by the Hasidim, they follow, they don't follow the Vilna Gaon. They follow what it says in Shulchan Aruch. It's preferable each person says his own Kiddush. So you have a family with 10 boys, so you're going to have, the father's going to say Kiddush, and all the 10 boys are going to say Kiddush. Everybody's going to say their own Kiddush. According to the Vilna Gaon, it really should be preferred that just like by Kiddush, you say one person says Kiddush, everybody's Yotze. Should really be preferred that one person should say the whole Haggadah. Sometimes the great-grandfather already can't see, so that's a question. If he's going to say Kiddush, can he be Moitzi everybody? Because the Gemara says that a person who can't see a Suma is Potter from the mitzvah of Sipa Yitzias Mitzrayim on Pesach night. So if he's Potter, he can't be Moitzi everybody else. Mishen Buchi Budobre and Emotzi Osarabi Mudechei Vosim.
The Gemara said he could.
So the Gemara says Rabbi Yosef was blind and he said the Haggadah. So the Gemara says because his opinion was that Matzah Bizman is only the Rabbanon, so the whole CPT is Mitzrayim is only with the Rabbanon. Because the Pasuk says, Babuzeh Lamarte Lebashashesh Matzah Mor Menachem Lefanecha. So if Matzah would have been the Rabbanon like Rabbi Yosef, the Amora was of the opinion, then the whole CPT is Mitzrayim is only with the Rabbanon. Because you don't have Korban Pesach and Mor Bizman is only the Rabbanon, according to Rabbi Yosef. Matzah is only the Rabbanah, so there's nothing there, there's no Zeh. So then the whole CPT is Mitzrayim is mid the Rabbanah. So Rabbi Yosef was of the opinion that Matzah Bizman is the Rabbanah, so therefore he's just as Mukhayyib as everybody else. He can recite the Haggadah, and he might see those who do have sight. But we paskan that Matzah Bizman is the Raisa, so the CPT is Mitzrayim is the Raisa. So based on the simple reading of the Gemara, if the grandfather can't see already, so he should say Kiddush for himself, fine. But the other Bnei Habayis shouldn't be lying his Kiddush, because the Kiddush is also part of the CPT Yisman Tzrayim. He can't really be Moitzi them, because he's only Mechuyib in the Rabbanon and in CPT Yisman Tzrayim, and they're Mechuyib in HaTorah.
The Sipur must be Mitzvah Chaksav? Can't be Balpeh?
Sipur can be Balpeh,
yeah.
But the mitzvah of CPT Yisman Tzrayim has to be Babazeh. Babazeh means something that I can see and I can point to. I have to be able to see the Korban Pesach, the Matzah, and the Morah. So Bizman is
that I must see, or that it must be there?
The Gemara says it's both. It has to be there and you have to be able to see it. The Gemara says that a Summa doesn't have, whenever there's a din of Zeh, Summa, it doesn't apply to a person who can't see.
Excellent. How much, Rabelsky, should somebody keeping one day participate in the second day during the Seder? In other words, somebody, Ben Eretz Yisrael, is visiting with his mishpacha here in America.
A Ben Eretz Yisroel should, you know, keep as much as he could of the second day so that he shouldn't violate the Minhag HaMokom. And of course he can't do Malachas, but he's definitely not Mechuyev to keep the Seder, to say everything. It's just...
He doesn't have to have a Seder altogether.
He doesn't have to have the Seder. So it's nice if he would sit by the table and join everybody, but there's no reason for being, you know, mechuyev in every detail of the Seder.
And the rest of Yontif?
The rest of Yontif, he shouldn't do any malachas at all, even bitzina, and he should wear big day Yontif, and come to shul, but... If he puts tefillin on at Chol HaMoed, he'll have to do it b'tzinah. And he should say the nusach of Chol HaMoed, not the nusach of Yom.
So when the Rebbe says b'tzinah, so there are certain communities where they have many, many guests coming from Eretz Yisrael, and they have a separate minyan in the same building as the shul. Everybody's coming for Yontif, and the minyan for Bnei Eretz Yisrael. Is that considered b'tzinah?
That's not a problem, because the only thing he can't do b'tzinah is malacha. He does malachas that are osur on yontif and mutar on chalmoid, so that's called that's a violation. He's doing it b'feresya, because every malacha is automatically assumed to be b'feresya. Someone will find out about it. But a minyan is different. I know that in Eretz Yisrael, when the Chutzlorot people.
The reverse.
Right. When they make a minyan on the second day, which is Chol HaMoed, or on the eighth day, for instance, which is Choil, everybody's eating bread. And the people from Chutzlorot are noeg like Yontif. They're wearing they fezach with Simchas Torah, and they're singing and dancing and making aliyahs and everything. And a lot of Rabbonim in Eretz Yisrael, you know, they scream that this is b'farhesia and it should be done quietly, no minyonim should be made. But people make minyonim anyway. I don't think anybody does it with sinner. So, well, in order to resolve that problem, we'll have to have the Geula come pretty soon.
Okay. Rav Shechter, can I use machine matzah, or am I required to use hand matzahs only for the Seder or all of Pesach?
The Gemara seems to say that the matzahs that you use for the mitzvah, matzahs mitzvah, for the Seder, the Kazayas, has to be Shmura matzah, Shmarta Masan matzahs, and Shmura, part of Shmura means that it should be made lishma. You need asiya lishma. So in order to be considered asiya lishma, first it has to be considered my asiya, as if a Jewish person has to do. A non-Jew who doesn't have the mitzvah of eating matzah, whoever is any b'toras, cannot create lishma. Women are mechuyev to eat matzah. If the din would have been that women would have been potter, like a normal mitzvah says the Shazman Grama, then women would have also not been able to bake matzahs. Ketanim who are not mechuyev in the mitzvah of matzah, also not able to create lishma. You have to be a Yeshna b'toras to create lishma. So that's a question. When you push a button and a machine is going for hours and hours and hours and baking matzahs, is that considered all mayasi or not? So the Gemara discusses in different places, Gemara discusses a difference between karech rishon and karech sheni. A person has, let's say, a reservoir full of water, and he picks up a dam and the water starts flowing, and he accomplishes a shchita with that. He has a wheel and he accomplishes, has a whole system, and he does shchita, or he uses that water for netilas yadayim or for ritzicha. The Gemara discusses. So the Gemara says that all three cases, netilas yadayim, shchita, and ritzicha, you need koyach gavra, and the halacha distinguishes between koyach rishon and koyach sheni. So what exactly does that mean, koyach rishon and koyach sheni? So some poskim hold that Dvar Avraham has a tshuva about this. I think in the third chelik, he's talking about filling a mikveh by pushing a button and the water goes automatically to fill up the mikveh. Does that maisa relate to me or not? So he claims that if it's karech rishon, it relates to me. Karech sheni, it's not my maisa. That's chiddush number one. He assumes that karech sheni is not only not acceptable for karech gavra, karech sheni is not called maisa ha'odom. And number two, he assumes that the definition of karech rishon versus karech sheni is, if you would push the button and you would let it go for 15 seconds or for half a minute, and then you would push it and stop it, how much would be accomplished with the initial pushing of the button just for half a minute? So if you push a button on the matzah machine and then you stop it after half a minute, no matzahs will be accomplished. Nothing will be finished. So according to his definition, that's called koyach sheni, and koyach sheni is not called maaser ha'odom. It's not maaser ha'odom, so it's not called asiya lishma. It wouldn't be acceptable for matzah. His opinion, I don't think, was accepted. The Kosher Glover has a tshuva about this. Kosher Glover was killed by the Nazis. And the Chazon Ish has in his sefer, they both quote the same Magen Avraham in Hilchos Netilas Yadayim, says not so. The Pashtus is that many hold that the difference between Karech Rishon and Karech Sheni only applies to those three cases, only applies to Ritzicha and Netilas Yadayim, and to Shechita we need Karech Gaber, something over and above Maisa Ha'odom, or that's one point where they disagree with Dvar Avraham. And then number two, they quote that this is called Karech Gaber. If you set up a whole system and everything goes because of the fact that I push the button, it is called Karech Gaber, it is called Karech Rishon. So in Europe, when they first started making machine matzahs, they didn't have, they still have the machines now in Vilna. They didn't have a system like we have today, that you, everything is done by the machine from the beginning to the end. They would knead the flour with, they would knead the dough by mixing with flour and the water. And then they would use a machine later on in the middle of the baking, in the middle of the preparation process. So that would cause it to take longer. The baking of a machine matzah took longer than the hand matzah. The many gedolim were upset. They said it's chametz dag and gomer, and the Mishnah, the Gemara says, you know, ain't ois mitzreik mahametz yorim pesach. You're not allowed to make shapes in your pesach cookies if you're using matzah mel. If you use matzah mel that was baked already, so it's not bolei dechimatz. You can't become chametz if you're using pesach dikah flour, like the flour that they use to bake the matzahs. So if you're going to make such cakes or cookies and make designs on them, it's going to take longer to bake. So the Mishnah says you're not allowed to do that. So that's why many Gedolei Maaser originally, the machine matzahs in Europe, they said it's chametz. because it's taking longer to bake. Today, Lamaisa, the machine shmura, the machine matzahs take much less time than the hand matzah. So there are many who feel that it's a midas chasidus, a dikduk bedavke to use machine matzahs as opposed to hand matzahs. It's more of a hider in shmura, it's more mishumah. On the assumption that it is called asiyah, and it is called asiyah lishma, the one who pushes the button has to be a Jewish person who has passed bar mitzvah, and who says he's baking a l'shem mitzvah's matzah, whenever you need l'shma, so we're machmed that you have to have amira. Mishnah Berurah quotes from the Achronim that even when you draw the water, the Maim Shalanu should also say that I'm drawing the water, the water should be drawn al-yidei Yehudi, not al-yidei Nachri, the Ramah says. When Yehudi draws the water, he should say he's doing l'shem mitzvah's matzah. That's already a chumer. But here, when you push the button to bake the matzahs, they should have an amira b'peh, that it should be considered asiyah l'shmo. So then we assume that machine matzahs are acceptable.
Okay, we're going to try to wind up in the next few moments.
Okay, I'd like to throw in just an interesting aside. You know, they had published a number of books called Svarim, with the history of Yerushalayim, Yerushalayim Shel Mala. I think there are three volumes. There's an English equivalent in one volume. And they tell stories of various tzaddikim who lived in Yerushalayim 100 years ago. Very, very great tzaddikim. Among them were people who came from every part of Europe. You know, Litvishe, Chassidishe, from Hungary, Sfardim, all over. And beautiful stories about these wonderful tzaddikim. They had nothing in common with each other as far as their minhogim and their way of, you know, pronouncing the language and so on and so forth. But this one thing, the Hatzad HaShoveh, that they all ate machine matzah. Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnefeld, everyone there ate the machine matzah because the machines were very much upgraded. So it's not as if that it's a kalas rosh. Every one of those heroic tzaddikim in these volumes ate machine matzah. Some didn't eat for the kezias during the seder, the kezaisim, but that's about it. They held it was more mahuder, like Shechter said.
Before we get to the last few questions, I just wanted to say a special welcome to my very dear chaver of Yosef Grossman, who joins us here in our room. Rabbi Grossman is the director of OU Education, and just today announced the release of a new CD on industrial kashering. Rabbi Grossman organizes the very many Ask OU programs around the country. One after Pesach will be in Brooklyn. So we're very pleased that he's been able to join with us here today in another one of our educational endeavors. I have a question here relating to something we discussed earlier about the spray, deodorants and so forth. A person asked, assuming most ethanol in the United States, Rovelsky, is corn-based, can one purchase and use perfume and other beauty aids using alcohol, or one must know, or should one know if it is from corn?
We mentioned before that if it's denatured to the degree that it's done now, it's mutter anyway. The stuff made in Europe, perfumes, and many of them come from France and Italy, these places. If it's made in Europe, it's almost certainly from grain. And in the U.S., it's from corn. There is a small percentage of alcohol made in the U.S. From grain. Rubidrub is made from corn.
And therefore?
Unless the product is made in the U.S., so then you probably have in it a grain alcohol, which is chomet, but which is nifsal, and you can't eat it. It's nifsal mechil anyway, so you won't eat it. And maybe you could eat it, because it's gemat nachayach to say achshavei over something that is so foul-tasting that you love to spit it out. So you can do anything with it. That's why people don't prefer not to take a product that's made from chometz and use it on Pesach. It seems like an anomaly, something that shouldn't be done. But mutabano asulach hazmanu, Chazal say it could be done. halacha is that you could take something that's nifsal, and the chorchoy is not as nifsal as especially denatured the alcohols. The chorchoy, which you're allowed to use, is something that if you eat it, it's achshavei according to the Rosh. Shagasari. But especially denatured alcohols could never become achshavei. It's impossible to restore it. Except, as we said before, for shikurim.
Rosh Hashanah, one question that Rosh Hashiva touched on before, but I want to again reemphasize because of the nature of the question and the way it's phrased, part of our attempt to also be mekarev of those who are not as yet as fully committed as perhaps many of us. This lady asks, what are the three or four most essential items necessary to purchase or prepare for a Seder that will only include the most basic important minhagim and will not include all of the prayers and the entire Haggadah for people that are learning about Pesach for the first time?
I mean, you're going to have a beginner Seder. You're going to abridge the Haggadah, you have to abridge. Okay, you got no choice, otherwise they're going to leave. What are the most important? You have to have matzah, morah, I guess charoses. About it. Salt water. Salt water, not a big deal.
And what else would you tell this group of people of Yidden who are searching?
You have to bridge as much as possible.
Besides the bridge, but what should they focus on? He says, what are the three or four most essential items necessary to purchase, prepare?
Don't know. To focus on when you run the Seder. I don't know myself. I never
it, it takes
like
the talent of a person who's leading the Seder, who sees his clientele, and he realizes what they need.
The Tzadik Nefesh Behemta, every rabbi has to size up his Balbatim and figure out what they need.
Yeah. Okay, finally, I have a question both for Rav Belsky and Rav Schechter. Before we conclude, as always, at the end of webcast, announce that anybody that has follow-up questions or questions that require further clarification could feel free to email to me at safran@ou.org. Being that this webcast is just a few short days before Pesach, if you get in those questions today, tomorrow, before the end of the week, then certainly Rabbi Gerstein, as always, will answer as articulately and beautifully as he does, in consultation with our poskim. Anybody that would also like to send in suggestions for future webcasts, we are eager to hear and listen and learn from our listeners as well. Very, very soon, soon after Pesach, we're going to issue the sixth of the OU Kosher DVDs, which are being used in schools, in yeshivas, in kollelim, in many, many homes, synagogues, youth groups. And this sixth OU Kosher DVD will feature Moreno Rav Belsky, Rav Nosson Goldberg, and Rabbi Loike in a very, very fascinating analysis of everything relating to tarfus in a chicken. The DVD is entitled What is Wrong with This Chicken? And we anticipate that it will be used extensively in schools, in yeshivas, not only in Limudei Kodesh, but in many, many schools that have science teachers who are B'nai Torah, or Rebbeim, who are science-inclined, will be able to use this extensively in learning of the halachas and in the appreciation of the science and the biology that is involved. Soon after Pesach, the Orthodox Union will announce its release, and you will be able to purchase it through our OU Kosher office as well. And finally, before we conclude, a gentleman asked that we ask each to Rav Belsky and Rav Schechter the question, in what area does Rav Belsky see the most mistakes being made with regard to Pesach observance? And in what areas does Rav Schechter see the most mistakes being made with regard to Pesach observance? Rav Belsky, you have the first shot at it.
As far as mistakes go, I really don't know. But I'll tell you what I feel needs the greatest improvement is that the head of the household or the one who's conducting the Seder, whether it's father, grandfather, great-grandfather, whoever is doing it, or if it may be a child who's really, you know, way ahead of the rest of the family. But whoever is conducting the Seder should do it in a way which results in people who are there to say to the attendees coming to feel at the end of the full Seder or the abridged Seder, depending on the circumstances, was discussed earlier, they should be able to feel that they are actually experiencing the excitement and the joy and the relief of Yetzias Mitzrayim, and it should be to the point where they should be makir toiv, to be so thankful and so recognizing of the chesed, of the wonderful good that Hashem Yisburach did for us, and how it benefits our lives, and they should be ready to get up and dance and sing and say hallel. You know, the Briskirov Zatzal had a Seder with his family, and at the end of the Seder, when he came to the point of B'chol Tor V'dor, Chayav Odom, he used the Rambam's Lashon, Laharis Esatzmo, Ikilu Yosmi Mitzrayim, to get up with his children and dance around the table. Because he felt that that's the climax of the Seder. There should be an overwhelming joy in HaKoras HaToiv. That should be put into the Seder. People should feel the actual Yetzias Mitzrayim, Liris Esatzmoi, and the Rambam adds to that too, Ki ilu ato yotza mishibut Mitzrayim. Our nusach is Ki ilu yotza mi Mitzrayim. But it really means the same thing. And that is the most difficult mitzvah to be Mekayim. Matzah, you could eat all five kezesim, and you could eat a big kezais. It takes a little extra effort, but you just have a chew a little more, and you'll get it down your beis habliyah. And the arba koisus, you get your correct percentage and everything. Those things are relatively easy. But the Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, which involves giving over the Mesorah, passing on the entire tradition from one door to the other, that even, you know, V'hoya ki emer aleichem b'neichem, even the ben who's a little resistant, the Hoytzi Asmer and Aklal should be able to walk away feeling the joy, the HaKoras HaToiv for Yetzias Mitzrayim. That's the most difficult part, and people just don't prepare it well enough so that they should do it properly.
One of the questions that you mentioned before, we never answered, about how much time should we allow the children to give all of the sheets that they prepared. I think that's a major problem. All the different yeshivas and all the day schools, the rabbeim a lot of times teach the children gematrios and rosh tevis and pshetlach and hishiomdo, it means this and it means that. They don't tell them the posh pshat. I think it's a problem on chumash also. They teach all the children pshetlach and all the psukim. I think we should try to straighten out the yeshivas and the chinuch and the day schools. They should teach the posh pshat without the gematrios and without the rosh tevis. They should know what the pirush amilas is. We shouldn't have the children eat up so much time with all these Rosh Tevis and Pshetlach. And then we finish the Afikoymen after Chatzos. So we finish the Abakoses after Chatzos. Children should be taught, they're trained to say over the Poshim Pshat. I think that's a big problem. I think there's also a problem with Abakoses. I think my impression is that many people don't know they're supposed to drink Rosh Kais. They just take a sip of wine. They think it's like under the chuppah, you take a sip of wine. It's not just a sip of wine. You're supposed to drink Lechatchila Kolakos and B'diyeva Rovakos. I think the drinking of abacosis is not done properly. The people exaggerate how difficult it is to drink abacosis. It wouldn't be Pesach night, it wouldn't be a Yetzer Hara not to drink, so they would be able to drink abacosis.
I want to thank Maronan Rabbanon, Rav Belsky, and Rav Schechter for this very, very enlightening and insightful session that we had here together. I have no doubt that our many, many listeners have learned enormously and have gained so much from these topics that we've covered this year beyond those that we've covered in past years. Again, those that have suggestions for future webcasts, which we have during the year, not in Pesach time, feel free to let us know. And also, before we close, I wanted to make mention of the fact that the Orthodox Union has initiated in the past year a new department of the OU Press, which is publishing very many wonderful works in Torah and Hashkafa. And last year, just before Pesach, the OU Press has issued the Haggadah with a commentary of Moreno Rav Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. And this year, the Haggadah that is entitled Royal Table, with comments and insights from Rabbi Norman Lamb, Chancellor of Yeshiva University. If you still would like to order these prior to Yontif, please contact the OU Press office, and perhaps you'll be able to enjoy these masterful works during Yontif. To all of you, and to Klal Yisrael, Chakosha V'Sameach, we should be zeichet to a real Geula Shalema this year, as we confront the very many challenges that Klal Yisrael, even today, faces. We look forward and anticipate to a Geula Shalema, Kibimei Yitzias Avaseinu Mimitzrayim. Chakosha V'Sameach.
Shalom. You know this?